Follow up to our monthly mail out that you, if you live in this area, that you received this week. Two parts. The first is on a GPS, and so you go to a child, your spouse, a friend. I need you to go to Ernie's house and pick something up for me. I can't. Why not? I don't remember where he lives. Well, go to 123 Sesame Street. I can't. Why? Verizon's tower's down and my GPS isn't working. Go east on 72. Go to Grover Street. Turn left, take it to Big Bird Avenue, turn right, or turn west, excuse me. Go three blocks and turn south. At that point, there's an interruption, isn't there? Where's Grover Street? Which direction south? What does three blocks mean? Okay, so we try again. Get on that road right out there. Go that direction. For 5 miles, turn left at the statue of Super Grover. Go until you see the big bird in the nest and turn left again. Another interruption. How far is 5 miles? Which one's my left? All right, here's a sticky note for your left hand. Turn left again, same hand. When you see the big green and yellow sign that says Sesame Street, 123 will be on your right, and that's the other hand without the sticky note. Numbers on the mailbox. Got it? Got it, but I can't go. Why? My GPS is broken, and I don't know how to get back home. Just give me the keys. But you try again as a parent. Okay. Patience is a virtue. Bring me a map. What's a map? All right, the patience is gone. Never mind, give me the keys again. If you've ever tried to give directions to anyone under the age of, say, 30... you know it results in a headache. Now listen, understand this. I love Google Maps. I love Waze, etc. I get it. But I can read a map. I can follow directions. I can read road signs. I can usually figure out north, south, east, and west. And I know which one is my right hand, too. So if the GPS goes down, I can get from here to there. As a culture, however, that is not how we function. If there is no service where we are at that tells us how to get where we're going, we cannot even leave where we're sitting because we don't know what direction it is. And if there's nothing to tell us as we're traveling how to get there, we're as lost as the proverbial goose in a hailstorm. I have met those who cannot go get the mail at the end of their own driveway without their phones telling them to make a U-turn at the end of the driveway and come back the same direction they just left. For that reason, well, explain this. Kim and I have been trying to teach Boo to drive. And so in my part of that, I have been trying to use phrases like, well, let me give you an example. The other day we were going to Mammy's to see Jake. He's going to drive, and when I get in the car, he already has his GPS on. So I let him follow it to get there. We're just picking up something. And so as we're coming back, I'm using phrases like, you're going to turn on Ezel Road. You're going to go half a mile and you're going to turn west. Because I would like for him to be able to get from here to there if his phone's dead. If there's no service. My oldest left one time and went to the fair in Lawrenceburg. He drove there, understand. Got there, arrived there. And when he left, I spent the next hour on the phone, turn by turn, trying to get him back home. Because he didn't know how to get back home. By the way, kids, 5 miles is when the odometer goes from 964 to 969. North, south, east, and west are normally, and 99% of any car younger than 15 years old, right there in front of you. And if you don't know your left from your right, well, parents, good luck with that one. Sticky notes or Sharpies is about the only chance you have. What's the point? The point is, when our GPS goes down, we're lost. It's true in a car. It's true spiritually. It's true emotionally. It's true, I make up words all the time, relationshiply, educationally, wellnessly. When the GPS goes down, we have no idea where to go. And so as we go to Luke 7, I want you to understand that in the Bible, Jesus is God's GPS. He is God's positioning system, and he is in all of those areas. And that's vital that we get that, as Chester was talking about, in between each song and introducing it and tying it to the previous one. We have a direction giving device at our disposal. And it will get us from where we are to where we're supposed to be going. If we will follow it. And when we lose him in the home, we are lost. We're going to look at an opportunity this morning that's missed. We're going to look at a story with contrasting GPS point of views or points of view. Two different characters, totally different viewpoint about Jesus being in that home. Tonight, we're going to look at an opportunity that was seized, and then we're going to show us how to do that. Both the stories, the one tonight and the one this morning, Jesus is present, and he's present in somebody's home. As Chester said, you can go through the Gospels, and Jesus is constantly making appearances in the homes of those who are willing to invite him in. Sometimes, like Zacchaeus, he invites himself and is accepted. So Luke chapter 7. Read for us verses 36 through 50. Simon, who is a Pharisee, so he is wealthy, he's educated, he's religious, he is a standout in their minds in his society. And he invites Jesus to come to dinner. Very quickly into the scene, another person shows up for the dinner party. She's local. She has a reputation. They know who she is the minute she walks in the door. And she is not welcome in Simon's house. But she's there anyway. And there are a lot of things that are happening in this story that are absolutely fascinating. The fact that she's brave enough to walk into the house. The fact that Jesus interacts with her. The fact that Jesus is going to read the thoughts of Simon and those at the table. The gift that he offers her. They're all beautiful parts of this story. But the key for us today is the reactions of the people to Jesus' presence. He is in Simon's house. He is a guest. And he is invited. He didn't knock the door down. He didn't do like he did with Zacchaeus and say, "Hey, I'm coming to your house for lunch. You better unlock the door," kind of thing. Simon goes and invites Jesus to come. And when he gets there, he opens the door and lets him in as his guest. But notice there is no hospitality. Verse 44, "Do you see this woman, Simon?" Let me contrast the two of you for a second, Simon. "I entered your house and you gave me no water for my feet." Cultural note, they're walking around on dirty, dusty roads in sandals all the time. And so Oriental custom, you remove your shoes when you come to the door, and then either a servant or the master of the house himself washes your feet for you, or they at least provide a bowl of water and a towel so you can wipe the dust off your feet and clean up and be comfortable. In our culture, it's what, "May I take your jacket? Do you need to wash up? Here, have a seat." There's none of that. Simon does not do anything to extend hospitality to Jesus in any way. He is also not welcome. Verse 45, "You didn't kiss me." We shake hands. We give a big hug. We give a slap on the back. They kissed on the cheek. Again, that Oriental custom, different culture from us. But Jesus comes in the door and there is no sign that Simon is glad he's there. Man, we snatch each other up in a bear hug. We, in today's world, maybe it's more knuckles, but anyway. If we've invited someone into our home intentionally, we want them to feel welcome in our home. So we extend hospitality, we welcome them in some way, but there's none of that. There is no comfort, verse 46. "You didn't give me any oil for my head. It is hot, it is dry, their skin cracks, their hair dries out," and so it was cultural to provide ointment when you came in the door. There's none of that. There's no, "Can I get you something? Would you like a glass of water?" So there's no refreshing, no refreshment offered at the end of this journey. Jesus is treated almost as if he's unwanted, even though he was invited. He's treated as an intruder by Simon. Simon even is questioning and accusing Jesus in his head when he interacts with this woman. So I want you to notice as we start that Jesus is inside the walls of Simon's house. But he's not in his home. He's not part of it. He's just there physically because Simon invited him. Then the woman enters. And she's the true invader. She does not have an invite. And in their culture, she's a woman. Very presumptuous for her to walk in. She's a woman of reputation. She is unwelcome in every way in Simon's house. Yet she's the one showing emotion at meeting Jesus. She's glad he's there. She's so glad that he's in Simon's house that she's busted up into the dinner party. She's excited to be in his presence. She just wants, "Just let me touch you. Let me wipe your feet for you. She extends all the hospitality that Simon was supposed to extend. She wants Jesus in her heart. She wants him in her life. And if it had been permissible, she would have been the one inviting him into her home. She wants him there. Simon never gets that point. Verse 49, he is still, it says those around the table, so this is going to include Simon still, are questioning, who does this man think he is? That he's going to forgive sins. The whole guest list is clueless to what it means to have Jesus visit your home. And so we can see the importance of wanting Jesus there. Of not just inviting him, but wanting him there. Not exactly sure. I lost a slide, so let me transition for you. The importance of wanting Jesus there versus did Simon just invite him because it was culturally expected of him? Did Simon just invite him like a lot of times that we see because he just wanted to rubberneck, accuse him? Whatever the reason, he doesn't really, really want him there. So this morning, I want to point out a couple of reasons that are very practical for wanting Jesus in our homes. And then tonight, we're going to look at the how. Number one, it is important for us to have Jesus in our homes because Jesus brings better life. John 10 and verse 10, I have come that they might have life and they might have it abundantly. The presence of Jesus and what he brings as the master and as the teacher is just a good thing. For example, take Matthew 7 and verse 12, what we call the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. If we just followed that as a culture, life would be better. We would get along better. We would treat each other better. And it's from the presence of Jesus in our lives. And then there's the Beatitudes in Matthew 5. That's just good stuff. That's just better than we teach in culture. He teaches us about responsibilities within the family. He teaches us about love instead of hate. Prayer instead of retaliation. Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. Just if we ignored the rest of the Gospels and just took the Sermon on the Mount from a practical standpoint, not even a spiritual standpoint, a practical standpoint, and applied it in our lives, life is better with the presence of Jesus. He just teaches us how to live a good life. Number two, it's practical to have him in the home because he is the great physician. In Luke 4, verses 38 through 40, a lot of teaching going on, a lot of healing going on, and he goes into the home of Peter. Still going by Simon at that time. And Simon's mother-in-law is sick. So Jesus heals her. And she gets up and serves. So it's an immediate, true miracle. She goes from deathly ill to completely well instantaneously. And then the crowds flock to him and he heals them. Now, he's not going to touch you in that miraculous way that he did in the Gospels. That time is gone. It has been fulfilled. It had a purpose. That's another lesson entirely. But those with Jesus in the home have the resources of the great physician at their disposal to cope with illness, to cope with disease, to cope with handicaps, to cope with long-term reoccurring things that can debilitate us. We have love. We have an immediate support system when Jesus is there. We can develop the patience to deal with things that are constant. We have comfort. We have hope. We can have peace. I cannot imagine, we'll use the current situation, I cannot imagine personally surviving what's going on with COVID and having experienced it myself as well without the great physician in my life. Just the knowledge that there is someone there who loves me enough that he gave his life for me, that he can provide comfort and joy and peace as we battle through this life. And if that ultimately leads to death, it is practical to have Jesus in our lives because he's the resurrection and the life. Mark chapter 5, he is on his way to the house of Jairus. Jairus has a daughter who is deathly ill. She is on her deathbed. And some things happen that are really interesting. Jesus gets interrupted and he pauses for a while. But he gets there and the hired mourners and the family are already there. They're wailing away because this girl has died. And Jesus says, you know, what's the deal? She's just asleep. And they laugh at him. They mock him. What they don't understand, though, is Jesus is the ultimate solution to death. When he says that she is asleep in verse 39, he is explaining to them that this is a passing state. Yes, she's dead, but it's temporary. Now then, she's going to get a miraculous one within her lifetime, if that fits, and get a chance to live again because the resurrection is there physically. But he's talking long term for them. Death's not the end. Death is a transition. It's temporary. It's passing. For the one with Christ in the home, Jesus is the victory. Death takes us from this world and all that it has to not offer to the next life where we get everything because Jesus is the resurrection. For those left to deal with the heartache, and yes, whether you lose a Christian or a non-Christian in your life, it hurts. Jesus is the great comforter. He created us. He understands us. He knows how to touch our lives. And then for those mourning the loss of one without Christ, he's the only way to deal with the pain. Number four, he's the source of knowledge and morality in the home. And I'm going to key on this one for just a second. 66% of the United States holds to the belief that there is no absolute truth. All right, so two out of every three people you meet on the street says that there is no standard of right and wrong. Right and wrong are entirely fluid. They are personal. So what's right for Tony is right for Tony, but if I don't like it, it's not right for me. And the world says that's good. And this is a movement that has been coming through the United States. We began wanting and demanding more freedoms. We began demanding less rules. We began demanding no conscience. Don't tell me things are right and wrong. I don't want anything to govern my thought processes. We began demanding no authority and no Christian influence in any realm. And this really begins to snowball in 1960. This is when we begin to see the rulings where God's taken out of school, where the commandments are taken out of school, where Christians are told to keep their faith private and not talk about it in front of others. And so that's where we're at today, full scale. As this tsunami engulfed the nation, we're talking about the home, right? It began influencing the home. Because we're raising kids in a culture that's saying there's no rules, there's no conscience, there's no Jesus. So they're coming home, no rules, no conscience, no Jesus. And as they become parents, that's the way they rear their families. So for the most part, in 2021, Jesus finds himself on the outside looking in. So here's the question. In my Wednesday night young adult Bible class, just dealt with this question. How has this great social experiment gone? How's it turned out for us? You know, are we better off as a nation than we were prior to 1960, when we still had some rules in place and we had Christ in the home and we had Christ in the schools and we had Christ in our government and we had... Are we better off? Are we a better nation? Are we better people? Really quickly, some evidence. And this is from the most updated government site available. Since 1960, our population has increased by 83%. But in that same 60-year period, violent crime has increased by 332%. So it doesn't have anything to do with having more people. Murder has increased by 80%. Remember now, this was triggered when we said, let's take away the fences and the rules. That, by the way, is low if you include the Holocaust of abortion. Since 1973, what? We've murdered 62 million children. That is an increase of 680,651% in murder in this country. Rape has increased by 713%. And these are only the reported crimes, the deaths that have been ruled murders and the rapes where victims came forward and said, I was raped. And so you have to take that into account, that all of these numbers are low. The number of prisoners in state and federal prisons since 1960 has increased 463%. We cannot build them fast enough to house criminals. The number of births to unwed mothers is up 461% in 60 years. Number of children who live in single-parent homes is up 200%. The teen suicide rate has doubled. Couples living together outside of marriage is 10 times higher than it was in 1960. And the divorce rate has more than doubled. In other words, our social experiment has failed. And it has failed miserably. In 1960, our courts began kicking God and Jesus out of every aspect of our lives. And we started down a hill and are still rolling. And it has not improved our nation, our people, or our way of life. It has destroyed it. Without God's GPS, without the Bible, without Jesus, and you lump all of that together, in society, without them in our schools, in our government, and in our homes, the only direction we can go is down. And I've just given you 60 years worth of evidence to that fact. Side note, it has never worked. It didn't work in the days of Noah. So corrupt that God said, I'm sick and tired of looking at you. It didn't work in the days of the judges. Every time the text says man did what was right in his own eyes, the nation fell apart. And that's just some of the practical reasons. Better life, the ability to deal with sickness and with death, and a moral direction. And there are others. But I want to shift to the spiritual benefit. In Luke 19, 1 through 10, and I've already referenced it, Jesus is coming down the road and he sees a man by the name of Zacchaeus. And Zacchaeus had wanted to get his eyes on Jesus. So Jesus offers him something even better. You come down and I'll come to your home for dinner. Now look at verse 9. In Luke chapter 19 and verse 9, Jesus makes a very interesting statement. Today, salvation has come to this house. If salvation arrived at that moment, if it has just now come to Zacchaeus' house, means what? It means there was no salvation before Jesus' arrival. Zacchaeus didn't know him. Zacchaeus didn't have him in his home. He didn't have access to the tree of life through Jesus before he agreed to let Jesus in his home. So the spiritual side of it, without Jesus in the home, there is no chance for mom and dad. There is no chance for Junior and his little sister, because there is no salvation outside of Jesus, Acts 4 and verse 12. There's salvation in no one else. There is no other name under heaven that has been given among men by which we must be saved. There's no other solution to what's going on in this world except Jesus in the home. Now, we can invite him in and still miss the opportunity to be saved like Simon did. But if we never invite him in, we have no chance at all. We're going to explore a story tonight where two occupants of the same house are blessed to have Jesus in their home. One almost pulls a Simon. One almost misses out on the opportunity. And I'm going to share some things that we have to do to make the most of his presence. But for now, it is a very simple key this morning. You have to invite him into your home. You have to invite him into your home by means of obeying the gospel. And I say that because Jesus in our homes begins with Jesus in us. And Galatians 3 verses 26 and 27 says, when we obey the gospel, we are baptized into Christ Jesus. At that moment, he comes into our homes. And then we'll talk about what to do with that tonight. But if you have bought into our culture that says no Jesus, no rules, no conscience, no right or wrong, look around you. You may so far be the exception to the rule, but sooner or later it will catch up with you. And what's happening in our world is spreading into our homes and into the church. And even if it doesn't end up leading your children astray, if there's no Jesus in the home, they're still going to stand before him without an option on the last day. So as we stand and sing, please invite Jesus into your home by coming and obeying the gospel. If you'll stand.